Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, when a filmmaker and his team set out to make a documentary about the Texas-Mexico border, they decided to take the wild view. First traveling by bike, then horseback, and finishing up on the Rio Grande itself, the documentary fully captures the diverse terrain and many species of wildlife that are a vital part of the landscape between the two countries. The River and the Wall introduces people living on both sides of the border and delves into the environmental complications that might crop up if a wall is built along the path traveled in the film. We'll hear from river guides, politicians, and bird conservationists seeing the border through a natural lens. Our conversation starts after a short break. Between the United States and Mexico is visually stunning wilderness. The stretch that cuts through Texas is home to winding paths, brightly colored birds, jutting hills, wild animals, and the Rio Grande itself. Depending on where you are, the river might be not much more than a trickle, or it might be raging rapids. So a filmmaker decided to ask, what's at stake if a border wall is built along it? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Ben Masters and his team set out to trace the journey themselves over the course of several weeks. Exploring the land before riding the river in canoes gave him the opportunity to get to know people on both the U.S. and Mexico sides of the border. Folks who feel like the decision to build a wall there doesn't spare a thought for the plants, birds, animals, and people who call that area home. His documentary is called The River and the Wall, and he joins us now to talk about it. Ben, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. So when did you get this first little kernel of an idea to take this journey and make it into a film?
I guess the whole idea started in the 2016 election. I've spent a lot of my life along the border. As a kid, worked on ranches just south of Brackettville. And then later on in college, I worked on a ranch for on and off for 5 years right outside of Laredo. And then I got into wildlife filmmaking in the past 6 or 8 years or so, and did quite a few film projects along the border and along the Rio Grande, out in West Texas in Big Bend, which is a place that I've always gone to with friends. And, you know, it's Texas's big wilderness area. And, you know, during that campaign, there was a lot of talk about building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, and at that point in time, I didn't know how serious if it was a physical wall, a metaphorical wall, where it would go, how it would impact everything, and selfishly, I kind of wanted to just go and see all that landscape with my own eyes while I still had that opportunity, because the Rio Grande has gone through a lot of places that are very near and dear to my life, and put together a group of people and said, let's go see every single mile of the border and go talk to the people that live there and take a few months and use horses. I've got 7 horses and bicycles and canoes, and go see it and document it and dive into this topic of, you know, how would a wall work, would it work, and what would the impacts be that it has.
You had a pretty game team, folks that were just right along there with you on this adventure. Tell me a little bit about the folks on your team for this.
Sure. So I decided to put together a team of 5, and the people that went with this was Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation Associate Director Jay Clayburg, who's from South Texas and spent a lot of time on the border. Heather Mackey is an ornithologist. She studied birds and butterflies along the Rio Grande for a few years. Felipe de Andrade is a wildlife filmmaker who's also an immigrant. And he and I have been friends for, I don't know, 6 or so years. And he came on the trip. And then Austin Alvarado is a first-generation American, but he's a river guide on the Rio Grande out in the Big Bend area, and has floated, well, I guess now he's done almost all the Rio, but extremely accomplished whitewater guide who had a great skill set in actually pulling the trip off.
So the first leg of your trip was bicycles, and not to tease you, but you weren't a fan, and the people on your team like to tease you about your bike skills. So there's a couple deeply miserable days on the bike part of the journey. Tell me about them.
So we kind of broke down the trip by transportation mode based upon really river flow and where the wall would be. And the Rio Grande in El Paso goes completely dry because there's all these dams and diversions and reservoirs in New Mexico and Colorado where it originates. So we wanted to take canoes, but there's quite literally no water for about 250 to 300 miles below downstream of El Paso. The Rio Grande's pretty much dry. So we did bicycles, and yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I was always kind of the B team guy in high school, and you know, I try really hard and get the award for most effort, but as far as skills go, my ambition often gets in the way of my ability, whereas all these crew were just mega athletes and freaking left me in the dust. And I had this dinky bicycle that I got from my little brother that I just really struggled to keep up for a mile. For like 300 miles, I was falling behind. But what really got us was a lot of the roads along the Rio Grande, where there is roads, a lot of places there aren't any at all. They're all, most of them are dirt. And whenever we got onto that dirt roads, it just started dumping snow on us, and we were not expecting snow. Mm-mm. And you know, that inches of snow just soaked into the soil, so instead of riding bicycles, the mud would get inside of the gears and inside of the pedals and inside of the wheels, and then it would freeze solid. So we had these worthless hunks of metal with just ice dripping off of them that were completely unusable. So instead of riding bikes for, you know, 100 miles through that stretch, we ended up just carrying them for as long as we could. And then eventually we gave up on the bicycles and were able to put them into a truck and just took off on foot for, I don't know, 50 or 60 miles or so of the border because the bikes were unreliable.
The scene where you guys are carrying the bikes is kind of like a funny slow-mo scene, like you're carrying like a soldier off the battlefield or something, but it's just these mud-encrusted, worthless bikes.
Oh, I'm glad you found humor in that moment.
So when did y'all switch to horseback, which was your time to shine, right?
Yeah, so we stopped riding bikes in the town of Presidio. And in Presidio, you have three massive public lands areas on the United States side. You have Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, which is the largest wildlife management area in the state, Big Bend National Park, which is the largest national park in the state, and then Big Bend Ranch State Park, which is the largest state park in the state. And combined, it's this public lands entity with almost no fences. That is about, let's see here, right around 1.1 million acres. And it's our land, and it's all adjacent to the Rio Grande. And I've spent a lot, I lived in Montana for a while, and I have Mustangs and have done a lot of backcountry packing. So through that big public land stretch in the Big Bend, we ditched the bikes, and we used my horses to travel through there. I've got 7 Mustangs, and that took about 2 weeks or so. And yeah, definitely for me, that was hands down the greatest part of the journey. It was just so cool getting to travel across, you know, those huge landscapes like that. It was such a neat mode of transportation, and I had that, you know, personal connection with all my horses. And really, that's the only spot like that left in the state where you can take off riding for day after day without running into a fence or, you know, a road or a wall.
There's a really incredible shot in the film where you're all riding in a line and you kind of look across the canyon and your shadows are riding along on kind of this rock wall across the way. I mean, did that just, when you saw that, did that just kind of encapsulate what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of times where you would just stop and look around you. And anybody who's been out to West Texas knows what I'm talking about, of just feeling minuscule and overwhelmed by some of those landscapes. It's awesome.
What did you most notice about the terrain on the bike slash foot slash horseback part of the journey? I mean, was it just an easy ride, an easy bike? Or, I mean, was this really challenging land you're moving through?
I've had the, experience, I guess. I've been very fortunate in my life to do some really amazing stuff. And one of those is we did a 3,000-mile pack trip from the Mexican border to the Canadian border through public lands in the American West back in 2013. So I've gotten to see a lot of public lands. And the public lands that we have out in West Texas, I think, rival anything out in the American West as far as just like sheer beauty and grandeur. But also with difficulty and terrain too. I mean, there are some canyons out there that are 1,000, 1,500 feet high. You have a ton of super deep arroyos, and cliff faces, and cactus. It's just a very harsh and rugged environment.
You all interviewed a lot of people about the idea of the wall being built in that terrain through Big Bend along the Rio Grande, including politicians. And someone you spoke to with is Republican U.S. Representative Will Hurd. And here's what he had to say about it.
In some areas where Border Patrol's response time is measured in hours to days, a wall is not a physical barrier, right? In some places where there's urban-to-urban contacts, a fence makes sense because Border Patrol can measure their response time in seconds to minutes. But doing it in the desert and in Big Bend, that's just crazy. Building a wall from sea to shining sea is the most expensive and least effective way to do border security.
And he's a Republican. He has a huge district that kind of stretches San Antonio to El Paso. Why was it important for you all to speak to him about this? We know that there has been Republican support for a wall, but to the Republicans that know the area, it feels a little bit different.
Yeah, definitely. In the film, we wanted to give both parties a voice. And we had Republican Congressman Will Hurd do a really in-depth interview with us. And then also, at the time, Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke, which is kind of funny. When we interviewed him, he had like 1,000 Instagram followers and nobody knew who he was. But Will Hurd, you know, is a Republican, and he represents about 800 miles of the border. And he also was in the CIA, and he sits on the Department of Homeland Security. And you know, as you just heard, he's vehemently opposed to a wall, a contiguous wall, I should say. He's in favor of a wall in some select urban areas, but he's, you know, very opposed to a wall in a lot of the border, just because he believes it's not an effective way of achieving border security. Because by the time you have someone willing to travel 100 miles across the desert, you know, for 4 days, that individual probably has the drive to, you know, get a ladder or climb over a 25-foot man-made structure as well. And he just thinks that there's a lot better ways to spend that money and better ways to do border security.
One thing he said is we already have a physical barrier. It's called mountains.
Yeah, I mean, out there you go for hundreds of miles of the Texas-Mexico border, there are massive, massive canyons that a professional rock climber could probably get up with the proper gear, but there's no way that people can get up it.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Ben Masters. His documentary is called The River and the Wall. Join the conversation by calling us at 800-933-5372. You can also tweet us at KERA Think. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Support for Think comes from ArtCan, a program of the Texas Cultural Trust and Houston Endowment, whose 2019 State of the Arts Report finds the arts contribute more than $5.5 billion annually to the Texas economy. More at artcantexas.org.
Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking with filmmaker Ben Masters about his new documentary, The River and the Wall, about a wild journey that took 63 days on foot, on bike, on horseback, and finally canoeing down the Rio Grande. Tell me a little bit about the river part of your journey. That seemed very different from climbing through terrain.
Sure. So we floated probably 650 to 700 miles of the Texas-Mexico border. The border is the Rio Grande River, or the Rio Bravo del Norte in Mexico. And the actual border itself is the deepest channel of the river. So it, you know, fluctuates depending on the different floods and stuff. But we used canoes, expedition canoes, and we paddled from the community of La Linda, which is in the Big Bend, through the lower canyons to Lake Amistad, paddled across Lake Amistad, which was very, that took a long time. And then paddled from Lake Amistad down to Laredo. And the Rio Grande goes through a very varying different types of habitat through Texas, you know, from a Chihuahuan desert into like limestone cliffs into these massive canyons, and then through this massive floodplain below Del Rio, and then all the way down to the lower Rio Grande Valley, where it enters into this very lush subtropical forest. But the part that really struck out to me was kind of where we began. And in Texas, we only have one river that's federally designated as a wild and scenic river, which is this kind of symbolism of only 1% of rivers in the whole country are wild and scenic. And we have one of those here in Texas.
So your river guide on this trip was Austin Alvarado, and he's a child of immigrants from Guatemala. And he spoke so interestingly while you were on the river, kind of about what the Rio Grande meant to him.
But I'd be lying to tell you that as a child of illegal immigrants, status wasn't in the back of my head. And it sounds awful, and I hate to admit it, but it has been. Like, why couldn't my parents learn English? Why couldn't they know how the school system worked? I just didn't understand. I was angry. I was mad. In the outdoors, the Rio Grande, that's somewhere where status doesn't matter. You know, it is a true level playing field.
So it was interesting to hear him speak about that, because you also heard kind of similar sentiments from people you interviewed. The river was something that everyone really kind of wanted to enjoy and be a part of, and it didn't matter which country you lived in or originated from or even what your politics were.
Yeah, I mean, I think Austin in particular was talking about how in the outdoor industry, you know, you're not measured really by your status as much as it is your physical ability. Mm-hmm. People judge you for who you are and not what country you were born in or whether you're a citizen or non-citizen or whatever. But I don't know. I wouldn't make that claim about everywhere along the border, because the border's 2,000 miles long. Mm-hmm. And in some places it is a vast wilderness, but in other places it's a very policed and militarized urban area that, you know, has a ton of people crossing over it. And it's different. Every mile is different.
Talk to me about some of the ranchers and landowners you interviewed who really kind of rely on the river as a good source of water in the middle of a desert. How do they conceive of the wall? I mean, how does that make them feel? What do they worry about if it is built?
Sure. Whenever we did the journey, we went through a lot of private land, obviously, because it's Texas and most of Texas is private. We met one landowner who was in favor of a wall. They had a wall built during the 2006-2007 Secure Fence Act, and he was appreciative of that because he had a ton of traffic going through his place. But he was the anomaly. The vast majority of the people that we met were very upset about a physical wall being built through their property because they weren't having a lot of issues with people going through their place, but they were, you know, not too stoked about the federal government seizing their land and blocking their access to the river or to a large part of their property, because the wall isn't going to be built on the border. It's going to be built on the U.S. side of the border, sometimes, you know, 100 yards from the Rio Grande, sometimes miles from the Rio Grande because of the topography challenges and the floodplain challenges. And yeah, I mean, there's some farms that are going to be, you know, sliced in half, and some ranches that are going to be split up that have been in people's families for generations, and we're talking about, you know, thousands of people, and they some of them are pissed.
Some people called it like a flat out land grab.
I mean, it is a land grab. It's the federal government coming in and seizing your land and saying this is not your land anymore.
Talk to me about that stretch of your journey where you guys were on the river, but there was no people from the U.S. on that side at that point. And you could see all these fishermen from Mexico and families and people recreating. And you all kind of expressed how eerie it was that you were the only Americans enjoying the river at all.
Yeah, so that is an interesting thing that we did notice. And I think it's important for people to realize that there's already a border wall or fence that exists along much of the border. After the 9/11 attacks, the Department of Homeland Security did a whole bunch of studies looking for potential weaknesses and potential future terrorist attacks. And one of them that they identified was that we had a very porous southern border. So they passed the Secure Fence Act in 06 and 07, and they constructed 650 miles of barrier. About 300 miles of that is, you know, what I would consider a wall. It's, you know, 25 feet high, steel, concrete, somewhat challenging to get across. And they put those walls in places where it would be advantageous to the strategy of the Department of Homeland Security, because a wall doesn't stop people, but it slows people down. And rather than, you know, blowing straight through an area, it slows people down anywhere from, you know, 30 seconds to a few minutes. And where they did build the wall or the fences was primarily in urban areas and in areas with very high traffic. So in Texas, El Paso already has a wall. Del Rio has a little bit of wall. Eagle Pass has some wall. Laredo has some wall. The lower Rio Grande Valley has some wall. So all the areas that have a big urban population already has some existing border fence. And one of the things that we did notice is in areas where there is a border fence or a wall, the communities that live on the American side feel uncomfortable going past the wall to the Rio Grande. And you contrast that with areas that don't have a wall, where the Rio Grande is kind of very much the center of that community. You know, it's similar to being in Dallas and going to walk down by the Trinity River by the water with all the municipal parks, or, you know, being in Austin and going to Zilker Park. And then on the Mexican side, you know, they have, you know, there's barbecues and soccer fields and people having a good time. And I do think that that's one of the things that a lot of people don't recognize about a wall is you're kind of cutting off people's ability to access the Rio Grande. And even whenever they do put in gates and stuff, people just feel uncomfortable going through this big wall to experience nature or to get onto the river. And I think that that's sad in a lot of those communities because they were built there. They were constructed there because of the Rio Grande.
What do people in Mexico think about the idea of a wall? I'm remembering the two fishermen that had hauled in these gigantic catfish at the part of the story that we were just referencing. You asked them about the wall, and what's the response you get from just the everyday Mexican citizen about a border wall?
I mean, there's a lot of different opinions in Mexico. I mean, it's gotten harder to come into the United States without, proper documentation. There's no doubt of that. And, it's been pretty documented that the cost for coyotes has steadily increased. And part of that's American security. And then part of that's also the fact that cartels have gotten into the drug smuggling business and they're regulating things on the south side of the border. But we met with quite a few people on the Mexican side who felt very confident that somebody who's desperate enough to travel from, Guatemala to Austin or from Honduras to Chicago, that they can also figure out a way to get over a 20-foot high wall. And in Mexico, like in Juarez, there are outfitting shops where you can go to and buy a kit that's specifically designed to cross over the wall in El Paso with like a map, with the right ropes to get over that particular wall and with the right gear. So, I mean, it's a business and there's a lot of really smart people that are in that business. For the steel slats in Lower Rio Grande Valley, you'll often see inner tubes from tires placed between the steel slats. So they'll go up to it, put the inner tubes in, and then just climb over it like a ladder. Mm-hmm. In the El Paso wall, there was quite a few cuts in the wall itself where there was like a little makeshift door that was created for people to get in and out. So, I mean, humans are smart, and desperate people are willing to go through great measures to find safety.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. To that end, didn't Philippe scale the wall at one point during the film? I remember him kind of shimmying up quickly just to see if it was tough and didn't have too hard of a time.
Yeah, no, we tested the wall in a few different places. And with the right gear, it's not that hard to climb.
Let's take a call now. We're going to talk to William in Wimberley. William, go ahead with your question.
Well, it's kind of a two-parter. You were talking about the congressman, and I know that I heard him speaking about a fiber optics system for security, which sounds like, to me, the wall is nothing but a symbol, and we know who wants that symbol, and it, as you have said, it's just so absurdly ridiculous. So that's part of it, and also the immigration issue that you've been talking about. I heard recently that, see what you think about this, that immigration is the one advantage we have on other countries such as Japan, Germany, China, that we are, without immigration, we will be below replacement level in population and our economy cannot grow, cannot sustain itself that way.
I'm going to stop you there just because we're a little short on time. Do you have, views on immigration, especially what he was talking about? It's an advantage to the American workforce and population?
I have really mixed feelings about it. I've researched immigration policy for 2 years now, and I think that it's something that's so complex that, to just spout off one answer, I don't think I could really fully give my full thoughts on it.
Sure.
But I do think that one of the things that people forget is that everybody who crosses, whether legally or illegally, they all have their own story, and they're all an individual, and they're all coming for different reasons, these different push-pull factors. And one of the things that frustrates me is whenever you just talk about this big population as like, oh, you know, these 11 million people, and they just kind of lump them together whenever all of them are seeking different things and are wanting to find different things and have different goals and are leaving a place that's all different. And that's one of the things that I hope people get out of our film. You know, Philippe and Austin both have their immigration story mm-hmm. woven into it. And I hope it humanizes, this issue. But I would like to talk a little bit about that gentleman's question earlier about the fiber optics. And what he was referring to is Congressman Will Hurd, who's a Republican, and he actually had some legislation that he proposed called the Smart Wall, which was essentially a way to achieve border security using drones and cameras and sensors and different technology instead of an actual physical wall that would have all sorts of these different, you know, ecological issues and private property rights issues, et cetera, that according to him would actually be a lot more effective than a physical structure.
Kind of like the idea of an invisible fence kind of thing that people use for a pet. I mean, just the idea that we shouldn't be building a giant expensive wall and we could use technology to achieve the same means and preserve the environment.
Yeah, exactly. Because if the goal of the fence is to, you know, detect somebody, to, you know, deploy a Border Patrol agent to go and apprehend them or to figure out who that individual is, then, you know, if the Border Patrol's response time to that area is 30 minutes, but it only takes 30 seconds to cross the wall, you know, what did it buy you? You know, it got you 30 seconds, but you could have done the exact same detection with technology.
My guest this hour is Ben Masters. He's a documentary filmmaker, and his new piece is called The River and the Wall. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can always tweet us at KERAThink. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ben Masters. His new documentary film, The River and the Wall, is debuting, I believe, today. Is that correct? At the festival? And we had an interesting conversation about this journey, because it's not just a documentary about the landscape. It's an actual journey you went on with your team, where you traveled just the full border with all these different modes of transportation. You were on foot at some point, on bike, on horseback, finally on canoe down the river Rio Grande. Tell me a little bit about whether you saw people trying to cross the border on your journey.
Sure. So whenever we did the trip, I believe we saw a few groups who seemed like they were staging on the Mexican side, you know, a group of six or eight people with backpacks that looked like they were preparing to go. Mm-hmm. But we only saw one group that was actually crossing the border, and that occurred south of El Indio, which is about 75 miles south or so of Del Rio. It's kind of a very rural type of environment along mm-hmm. the Texas-Mexico border, where an individual crossing there would probably have to travel 60 or so miles minimum before they were able to get onto a major highway system. And it was kind of a crazy circumstances that all manifested into one, but the Rio Grande in that stretch, and the Rio Grande's the border, the Rio Grande in that stretch in some areas is, you know, a half mile wide, and it has these different channels and currents and cuts, and there's islands in it, and there's different sets of rapids, and it's kind of difficult to know what the best way to go is down the canoe without getting stuck on the rocks and so on and so forth. So I ended up going right, which I thought was the best route, and I ended up getting stuck on some rocks, and my team, which was behind me, went left, and they ended up finding this beautiful little chute that shot them forward. Well, I got unstuck off the rocks and then went ahead about 600, 800 yards or so, and stopped to wait for them. And I had gone around this small little bend, and I had assumed that they were behind me. Well, they had taken a different channel, and then they stopped about a mile ahead, assuming that I was behind them. So both of us were stopped in the river waiting for the rest of our team to get there. We had very limited cell phone service, no way to communicate. And we were told earlier that day by some Mexican cat fishermen that there was kind of quite a bit of traffic, including some with drugs in that area. And while we were separated, it got dark, of course. And the rest of the group decided to kind of continue going around a bend to see if I was there. And they were going down the river, and kind of right at twilight, they ran into a group of maybe one or two dozen people that were loading backpacks onto a boat, and then taking it across onto the American side. So they were coming into the United States and bringing in backpacks of, we don't know, it could have been their clothes, it could have been an extra pair of shoes, it could have been some lunches for a few days, it could have been, you know, a 40-pound bale of marijuana. You don't know. And so my team just stumbles into this, and, you know, we're in green canoes and speaking English, and I'm certain that they would assume that we were Border Patrol. So they got really nervous, and then my team got really nervous, and these individuals that were crossing ended up throwing all their stuff back into the boat, going back into Mexico and getting into the brush and hiding, and then our group then heard a bunch of crackling in the cane and in the brush on the American side. So they thought that they had split this party into two that were either, you know, crossing illegally or smuggling drugs across. And they were right in the middle of them, stuck on the river on a bunch of rocks, missing a member of their team. So they didn't want to continue because they were worried that I would run into them by myself. But they couldn't go upstream because they had these big canoes laden with a week's worth of gear. So they just stopped right there and yelled out like, hey, you know, we're just a bunch of filmmakers going down the river and we mean you no harm, but we're just waiting for a member of our team. And then about 10 minutes later or so, we managed to get a cell phone call out where I got a hold of them and found out that we had been separated. And then I ended up going and meeting up with them, and then we continued down. But it was really stressful. It was very stressful, and it was scary. You don't know who you're going to run into down there. You know, it could be a person from Mexico who's trying to get into the United States for economic reasons. It could be an asylum seeker from Honduras who is seeking a safe place to live. It could be a, you know, narco trafficante who's got $15,000 worth of methamphetamine in his backpack and is under severe pressure by the cartel to get his load across safely and not get it lost. And, you know, for us, it was extremely stressful because we didn't know who they were. And then for them, I'm certain that they were incredibly stressed out as well because they had no idea who we were. And it gave a lot of insight into just how challenging it is for, you know, a lot of the people down there who live on the border, and I think to Border Patrol as well, because whenever you see somebody crossing, you don't know what their intent is. You don't know if they're dangerous. You don't know if it's a mother with a kid seeking a better life.
Let's take a call now. It's interesting that you brought that up. And I think a lot of people, it's just hard to know what any motivation is for an immigrant, but I'm sure the stress was acute at the time. Let's go to now to Henry in Austin. Henry, you want to go ahead with your question?
Jay, everybody seems to think about the poor people that come from South America that are trying to get in and their issues. But I'm a small business owner, and I have to compete with other people that hire illegals and pay them less than the minimum wage. And it's very hard to compete and do legally. It's very hard to compete with other people hiring illegals. And you got to provide jobs for 2,000 more people every day, because that means how many people are crossing illegally every day. And plus, we're going to have to support them with some sort of subsistence, because they are being underpaid by people that are hiring them and paying them less than the regular wage.
Well, I know you're not an immigration expert exactly, but I mean, what do you have to respond to that? I mean, there are a lot of people crossing, and he's making the point that some are going to need jobs and some might need social safety nets. Any thoughts on that? Just things you learned while you're making this film?
I learned that it's really complex and really nuanced, and it's easy to bunch people into a stereotype. And the issues that he brought up are very real issues. You know, the fact is that there's 11 million people that are undocumented living inside of the United States, and they don't have the ability to have a lot of the basic services. And at the same time, they can be taxing on resources, you know, like emergency rooms and other things. So it's not, and by no means do I not believe our immigration system needs some significant reform. I think that everybody believes that should happen. And I think that our film goes into that in a manner that I hope brings a lot about some of that discussion of what exactly does that mean. We have a lady named Victoria De Francesco Soto, who's an immigration policy historian, who gives us a 50-year backstory of different working visa programs. You know, the reasons why Ronald Reagan gave 3 million individuals amnesty in the 80s. And then, you know, in the film, Beto O'Rourke gives some of his opinions on what we should do with immigration policy from kind of a Democratic perspective. And then Will Hurd gives some ideas of immigration policy from a Republican perspective. But what I think what needs to be separated out is the difference between immigration policy reform and the construction of a physical wall. Because a wall does not equal immigration reform.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. I do want to ask you a little bit about the visuals, because we've talked so much about the kind of the philosophical journey of this film. But, I mean, the visuals are incredible. And I'd love to know a little bit about some of the wildlife that you ran into along the way.
Sure. So, you know, one of the characters in The River and the Wall is the landscapes of the Rio Grande. And fortunately, it was very easy to make it beautiful because, in my opinion, it's the most amazing part of the state. We filmed it. We shot quite a few days out of a helicopter. We did a ton of time lapses. There's a few drone shots. And then in addition to the cinematography during the journey, we also spent about 6 to 8 months worth of cameraman time out in those regions, filming the wildlife, filming the landscapes, catching the light right, to try to show people what the border looks like, because obviously not everybody can go do a journey down the Rio Grande and see for themselves you know, the different areas and the nuances, although I encourage everybody to do so if they want to. But, you know, hopefully people will watch the film and it'll kind of give the border a face and a voice, because it's so much more than a black line that is, you know, easily discarded and expendable.
Tell me about some of the animals you ran into.
For animals during production, we filmed we got a wild mountain lion on film, which is just amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like the highlight of my wildlife cinematography career. bears, black bears, amazing Texas story of black bears are coming back. They were completely extirpated from the state. They're slowly recolonizing from source population in Mexico. We got just bukus of different waterfowl, and then Lower Rio Grande Valley, which is one of the most, it's like this biological hotspot of different wintering birds. We got, I don't know, dozens of different bird species and ocelot. We got some ocelot on footage, not wild ocelot, but kind of representative ocelot from a zoo. Desert bighorn sheep, mule deer, whitetail, coyotes, bobcats, yeah, a whole host of animals.
There's a great shot of a deer like bounding out of the river, right?
Yeah, it's yeah, so crossing cool. the Rio Grande.
I just have never thought about a deer crossing the river before. And yeah. I mean, some of the people you interviewed said that had been there for a long time in that area said they used to go back and forth, kind of like they were crossing the street when they were young. I mean, so this is like, this area is home in more than a way if I have land on one side. I mean, some people view the whole region as kind of like their backyard.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think especially 15 or so years ago, before the border kind of started having some cartel activity on the Mexican side, it was a lot more open. But I mean, I've gone in Juarez multiple times, Matamoros, Reynosa, Acuña, you know, Oenaga, Boquillas. There's a lot of really wonderful communities on the Mexican side that are neat to go visit. And then, you know, vice versa. Every single day, there's tens of thousands of people that cross back and forth the river to go to work.
We've only got 30 seconds left, but do you have like a favorite shot or a scene that you just think really represents what you set out to do and that you're especially proud of or moved by?
I think that there's a scene in the film, there's a particular shot where Heather talks about it's like going through the Grand Canyon. And it's this rising shot out of the lower canyons with these itty bitty tiny canoes that are just swallowed by this massive landscape. And people that watch it like have no idea that we have this massive wilderness in these landscapes along the Rio Grande that really do rival the most famous national parks in the world. It's an amazing part of the state.
We're speaking this hour with Ben Masters. He's a filmmaker, and his documentary is called The River and the Wall. Ben, thank you so much for taking the time. What an interesting conversation.
All right, thanks for having me.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, and for Chris Boyd, thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.